Good evening. It's good to see you here. I suppose I should turn this technology on. Quote a TV commercial, can you hear me now? We're not here this morning. We were speaking in Bradford, but it's good to be back to the home church. We are working in Titus, somewhat of a disjointed study, and so we started with the greeting and what the intentions were of the Apostle Paul to set things in order on the island of Crete. We went on to the things he warned about when appointing elders that the elders should not be engaged in, and we went on then also to speak of the things that were qualities that the elders should have. Now we get to the false teachers, and I'm going to read in Titus 1 verses 10 through 16, and then we will look at them in some detail. For there are many rebellious men, empty talkers and deceivers, especially those of the circumcision, who must be silenced because they are upsetting whole families, teaching things that they should not teach for the sake of sordid gain. One of themselves, a prophet of their own, said, Cretans are always liars, evil beasts, lazy gluttons. This testimony is true. For this reason, reprove them severely, so that they may be sound in the faith. Not paying attention to Jewish myths and commandments of men who turn away from the truth. To the pure, all things are pure. But to those who are defiled and unbelieving, nothing is pure. But both their mind and their conscience are defiled. They profess to know God, but by their deeds they deny him, being detestable and disobedient and worthless for any good deed. So Paul here is taking a very strong line against these individuals. And indeed, false teaching is one of the worst things that can possibly come into the church, because it is so very dangerous. If we look at, and this is a translation I have borrowed from a man much more literate in Greek than I am, for there are many uncontrolled ones. Okay, so this shows no discipline. Vain talkers, mind deceivers, especially those out of the circumcision, whom it is necessary to stop the mouth. Ones who upset whole houses, teaching things they must not for the sake of shameful gain. Some one of them said, a prophet of their own, Cretans are always liars, evil beasts, lazy bellies. This testimony is true. For which cause rebuke them sharply in order that they may be healthy in the faith, not holding to Jewish myths and commandments of men, turning themselves away from the truth. All things are clean to the clean, but to the polluted and unbelieving, nothing is clean, but even their mind and conscience has been polluted. God they are professing to know, but by their works they are denying, being abominable and unpersuaded, and for every good work discredited. Now, we know this portion is not prophecy for the future. The verbs here show that this is something ongoing. And so we assume that these false teachers are in the church as professing Christians, because if they were outside, the issue would be different. There was many pagan gods at that time, and also many different philosophies and schools of philosophies in the culture of the time. And the warnings here are not about them outside. It's about them coming into the church. That's where the danger is. So the letters of the New Testament are very specific in that Christians are reminded to keep away from such things, but they're also told that God judges people outside of the church. There's no need for us to go sit in his chair, and it would be very presumptuous to do so. So the church is not told to engage such movements or resist them or fight them outside the church. We're rather to preach the gospel to any who come and any who will listen. And so the church becomes a force to change society as it brings people from God to God, and the change comes from the inside out. And it's very difficult to change people from the outside in, because you can put any number of rules on them you want, but that doesn't mean they wish to obey the rules or they're going to obey. So as we meet our false teachers, we're first told they're uncontrolled or rebellious. And they desire to go their own way. They wish to do things as they please. And they're not submitting to any authority. And they're not clinging to the gospel. Remember when we spoke about the overseer, one of the qualifications is we want him to cling to the gospel, hang on tight. You know, this could have been written specifically for our times, right now, today. Many people are changing the gospel. They're editing. Okay. So some things are deemed to be uncomfortable, so we're going to edit those out. And some things are deemed to be lacking. We're going to add those in. And they teach this revised, if you will, edited gospel to others. But it's not the gospel. It's something that has been made up of man with a smattering of the gospel in it. But, you know, you could take a gallon of good, clean water and put just a pinch of manure in it, stir it up. How many here want to drink it? I don't think so. So Paul is saying here, I do not want you taking my gospel, which is the water of the word and the water of life, and I don't want any pinch of manure put in there, and I don't care how much you stir it. You got to stop. Accountability is very important in ministry. And there's nobody that's so correct or so bright or so spiritual that they can say, I don't need accountability. I need accountability. Okay. And so as I talk with Pastor Colby sometimes over what I want to present, and as I talked with Pastor Heyman in the past, they might say, well, I think it might be better to go over this other direction, or I think you might want to emphasize this point more, or I think you might want to emphasize that point less. Now, that's what accountability is made of, and we also meet with Pastor Colby, and we chat with him about the messages and so forth, and go back and forth, and it goes like, well, what do you think about this, and what do you think about that? And these are growing exercises, if you will, because if you just use what's in here and you don't get any other viewpoints, that's all you've got, and that's all you're going to have. That's why we read good books, and we say, oh, wait a minute. I didn't think about that before, but I'm going to think about it now. So vain talkers can also be translated as empty talkers. They talk, but they don't have anything of value to say. So, you know, if we look at the truth and error scale, they're over on the error side. And it doesn't matter how much they talk. The multitude of words cannot compensate for the erroneous ideas. They're doing damage to the ministry. They're deceiving believers with their false teaching. Now, they're identified as especially those out of the circumcision, but not exclusively, because we have two things here, okay? And so we see they must be silenced because they're upsetting whole families. but we talk about Jewish myths and commandments of men over in verse 14. And of course, there's many commandments of men out there today. You should do this, you should do that, you shouldn't do this, you shouldn't do that. But they're just that. Now, Jewish believers were mixed with Gentile believers in the early church. That's changed now. And the dividing line between Jew and Christian was nowhere near as distinct as it is today. In the early days, Christianity was treated as a sect or an offshoot of Judaism. And if we're going to be brutally honest, the separation between Christian and Jew today is mainly the result of Christians persecuting Jews when they obtain political power, something we don't like to talk about. It's a true fact of history, nonetheless. But it's likely that this early church in Crete consisted of Jewish believers saved by the preaching of Peter at Pentecost that went back home, because it says there were Cretans there, and new believers. And most likely, it started out in the synagogues. And remember, Paul taught in the synagogues wherever he was permitted. And the Messiah was promised to the Jews, and the Christian religion was preached by Paul as the fulfillment of the promise to the Jews. In fact, the Jewish religion was a recognized religion, a permitted religion, if you will, in the Roman Empire. The Jewish leaders were permitted to run their own affairs. And that's why they could take Paul out and beat him if they didn't like what he said. He submitted to that in order to gain entry to the synagogue. He was a Roman citizen. He didn't have to. And so the Jewish leaders might also go and appeal to civil authority if they wanted to stop Paul from his preaching. But later, when Christianity was recognized as a distinct religion, and it was not a permitted religion in Rome, that's when the bad persecution started, the various waves of Roman persecution. So, what do we know about these teachers? Not a lot, and I do not want to speculate. We know that Jewish Christians were insisting that Gentiles be circumcised and observe the law. If we look at 14:15 and jump forward to 3:9, we see reflections of purification here. Now, this could include the many washings. It could include aspects of kosher rules. Also mentioned are Jewish myths and genealogies, along with controversies and disputes about the law. We know the rabbis embroidered all sorts of complex myths and rules around the law, and there was different schools of thought arranged around different popular rabbis. There was Gamaliel, there was Hillel, there was a number of them out there. And this oral law was called the tradition of the elders. It was grafted onto the written law, and it was considered to be authoritative. So Paul goes on to say it's necessary to stop the mouth. Did you ever have kids fighting in the back seat and you wanted to stop the mouth? I have. The sense here is close to gagging someone to stop the flow of speech. Just stop the mouth. In other words, the teaching is damaging. Now, unlike the sinner at Corinth that Paul wrote about, there's no advice to put him out of the church. Okay, that's not in the missive, but rather stop the false teaching. They were teaching things that they must not. In other words, they were promoting false doctrine. And the danger is that whole households were being upset. The verb is in the present tense, so we assume the action is ongoing. Now, the church met in households. There was no church building. There was no parsonage. They met in households. And so the upsetting or disrupting of these households is a big issue. That would be similar to upsetting of the church now so that doctrine couldn't be preached. And you see that sometimes we've had news of, for instance, someone that was very charismatic and in the church working to change the doctrine, and then you see a church split. And then there's always a big question, well, who's going to retain the building and who's going to leave? The loser in that battle is not always the scriptural individual, to our sorrow. So the church was the household, and the household was the church, because the meeting was there, the Lord's Supper was there, and also because it was an atrium where people came in, that's where the influence to the outside world was. So, you know, somebody is there waiting to buy olive oil from the guy who has the household, and there's a service there, he gets saved. Gets saved on the way to buy olive oil by the witness of the church in that household. Now, the motive of these false teachers is specified as for shameful gain. It goes back to the Cretan tendency for avarice that was mentioned earlier. And apparently these teachers desired to get some sort of financial benefit from their teaching. And so this makes the danger worse, because Christians were not only listening, but they were evidently giving money to advance this particular cause. Financial support would permit this teaching to grow. So teachers of some kind of philosophy or some sort of idea, some sort of Roman or Greek gods, were common at the time. They're all over. And so in Greco-Roman times, there was a deep-seated suspicion of someone who was teaching for money and only for money. And there was a cultural idea out there that they should try to teach and impart the information, you know, for the love of the knowledge they had and caring about the education. Actually, this concept continues to this day. You see it out there. Are they teaching for the love of teaching, or are they teaching for money? There's ancient writings harshly critical of those who taught for money. In verse 7, we saw the overseer warned about sordid gain, and we know that Paul, if you look at Acts 20:33, made it crystal clear he did not teach and preach for money. He says elsewhere he has the right from preaching the gospel to gain his living from the gospel, but he gave up that right because he had intense desire to give more. He said, I've got to preach the gospel. Woe is me if I don't preach the gospel, but I want to give more. So Paul didn't want the evangelists in the church confused in any way with the various philosophers that went about teaching to make money. And so he takes a common cultural theme and gives it a twist to apply it in this particular case. Now, he goes on to see that one of them said, and this means a person from Crete and a prophet, said, Cretans are always liars, evil beasts, and lazy gluttons. That's a pretty harsh criticism. I would like that said about my country. He's not equating this man to prophets in the Old Testament or prophets in the church, but he's showing that this man had status on Crete. He is a Cretan, and he gives an honest opinion of his fellow countrymen. This is the culture they're dealing with. Cretans are always liars. Actually, the reputation for deceit of Cretans was widespread in the ancient world and reflected in ancient writing. Evil beasts. Crete had a civilized culture, and the people could not really be called savages. Some people were in the ancient world, but Crete lacked wild animals. It was an island. And so the author of the quote is saying, even though wild beasts are lacking, the people themselves make up for the lack of it. There was war between various cities. There was robbery. There was piracy on the sea. So Crete, in that respect, was a dangerous place. Lazy gluttons, those who are enslaved to their appetites with no self-control. Then he says, this testimony is true. I don't think there's any doubt that the object in mind was the group of rebellious teachers. And as teachers are supposed to be truthful, and we look at the Cretan propensity to lie, these teachers are condemned by Paul for failure to follow his gospel. They're not clinging to it like the elders were supposed to do. Too much of Cretan culture is trying to come into the church. Those in the church have been saved by the gospel from the excesses of that culture and should not go back into it. Now, this also could have been written for the church today. There is culture outside these walls constantly trying to come in. I don't care what area of life you look at, there is American culture. You've got materialism out there. You've got excess out there. You've got greed out there. You most certainly have lying out there. Lying in the political realm has become something we shrug at. That. It's out there. We know it's out there, but it can't come into the church. It can't become acceptable. It can't become permissible. So, Titus was to rebuke the false teachers sharply, but the goal was restoration. He's not advised to put them out of the church. Healthy in the faith is almost a medical image. It carries the idea of being ill and needed to be cured. You're sick. Okay. We're going to open you up and pour you full of gospel to make you well. These people are in need of a healthy faith. And it pays no attention at all to false doctrine. Now, the word in holding to Jewish myths indicates an attachment which is a wrong attachment. And it's not correct. So the overseer, on the one hand, was to cling to the gospel, and we see our false teachers clinging to myths. We don't know exactly what was being taught. We know there was a big body of Jewish mythology. You got the Babylonian Talmud, you got the Jerusalem Talmud, and it's strange because if you read them, there were so many rules in those that the common people, which were said by the Sanhedrin not to understand anything, couldn't possibly keep track. One small example. If I take some vinegar on the Sabbath and I gargle with it, to give me good breath, that's not work. It's okay. If I take some vinegar and gargle with it on the Sabbath because I have a toothache, that's a medicinal effect. That's work. I can't do that. And time would not suffice to list all of these things, and it's no wonder the people couldn't follow it. Another example would be your religious leaders confronting Jesus because his disciples didn't wash their hands before eating. They said, you've transgressed what? Not the law, the tradition of the elders. Matthew 15:2. And Jesus was explaining to his followers that things like food that went into a person, went through the digestive system and were eliminated, did not make them defiled. But wicked thoughts and intentions out of the heart were what would defile a person. That was revolutionary in the time because being defiled was a huge issue. When Jesus was talking to the Samaritan woman at the well, she could hardly believe that he would ask for a drink. Because to do that to a Jewish rabbi would defile them. Taking a drink from a vessel from a Samaritan. Now, the phrase commandments of men could include Jewish myths and the inclusion of religious thought from Greece, Crete, which was not in accord with the gospel. Most religious thought from the ancient Greek and Roman world tended toward people getting favors from the gods by various actions that they did. So in other words, you did various things that were pleasing to the gods, and then they would bless you. That hasn't gone away. It's true of most man-made religions to this day. Yes, even some churches will say you can be saved by faith in Christ, but you must also obey the commandments of the church. Okay, you must also participate in these various sacraments of the church. So it's this plus this, and so things have been added. The idea of a free gift of grace in which we are saved not by our own works but as a gift of God was unique. It still is unique. It's still revolutionary. This church here does not control salvation. I do not. The pastor does not. It's a gift of God. It's for everybody. Anybody can follow Christ. And God desires for all to come to the knowledge of the truth. Paul goes on to say, all things are clean to the clean. Okay? Now forget about flusies, and I want you to understand what we're saying here. This is inner purity. This is being defiled. And it's an echo of the teaching of Jesus when he was confronted on the notion of hand washing in the tradition of the elders. We wash our hands today because we know about germs. But we don't believe that if we touch a Samaritan woman or something else like that, we'll be defiled. We don't believe that. And to eat with unwashed hands or to defy rules about vessels in the household and other things, that would get you defiled. And to this day, the ultra-Orthodox Jew does not want to sit next to an unrelated woman on the airplane, lest she touch him. Happens in LaGuardia on flights to Tel Aviv. Paul said, if you are clean, all things are clean. So in 2:14, if we jump forward, he talks about Jesus Christ who gave himself for us to redeem us from every lawless deed and to purify for himself a people for his own possession, zealous for good deeds. And so, salvation is a cleansing. You were cleansed. You were cleaned up. So who is not clean? The person who is not saved. And if not, how can you get clean? And those who are defiled by unbelief cannot get clean no matter what ritual they follow. Okay? So it doesn't matter if you keep kosher on one side or burn eagle feathers on the other side, the ritual's not going to help you. Salvation comes from the inside out, and it can't be imposed on the outside by any rule or any ritual. The verb here speaks of past action, and Paul goes on to say their mind and their conscience have been polluted. It's not working right. Can I give a modern example? I'm glad you asked. Think about our drunk driver who wraps his car around a tree. His mind evaluates the road, his speed, weather conditions, traffic. He's good to go. He's safe. But his mind is polluted by alcohol. And so the instrument that he's using is bad. It's not sound. And so, the result, cars off in the ditch, stop by the next tree. Even so, the person who has a mind and a conscience polluted by unbelief is unable to distinguish the proof and the truth of the gospel. He doesn't see it. He doesn't see it. And they resist it. In this case, we have commandments of men or various Jewish myths that these people are heeding, and these things are contrary to the gospel. And so they turn away from the gospel. They say, I'm going over this way. Such persons claim to know God. This is where the danger is. Okay? This claim is what they use to persuade people to listen to their teaching. And false teachers commonly claim to have a better or more complete knowledge. So watch them. Because they're taking that gallon of water and they're slipping in that pinch of manure. You don't want it. You don't want it. He says, though they claim to know God, by their deeds they deny the claim. They are abominable or detestable. That brings to mind the deeds of the people in the Promised Land before Israel came in. They are disobedient because they don't want to follow sound teaching. And they're similar to pagans who have never heard the gospel. But the hook in their teaching is that they claim to know God. Now, if someone knocked on your door with a white shirt and tie on and say, "We're Druids from over in England. We worship trees." You say, "Oh, come on now, get serious." But if they knock on your door and they say, "Would you like to know what the Bible really says? What it really means? Would you like to have a further testament above and beyond and in addition to the scriptures that explains many things that remain unanswered?" There's the hook. And there's the danger. Nothing they do is good or can be considered as good. Now contrast this with 1 Timothy 3:1 when they talk about deacons. It says, or overseers, a man has a desire to do a good work. It's what he wants. That's what he's going for. That's his desire. So despite their intention or their desire, your false teachers cannot do any good work. Paul speaks elsewhere of every good deed in 2 Corinthians 9:8 or Ephesians 2:10. It's seen as an integral part of the Christian life. Elsewhere he says, do good to everybody, starting with a household of faith. Now, there are times in the church, and now we get where the shoe sometimes pinches, when differences exist and they must be tolerated. Romans 14 is our definitive description of that. And it's very important that Romans 14 is contained within the household of faith. We're all mixed together. We're all a body. Jews and Gentiles were in the church along with very new Christians who had come out of pagan worship, the pagan temples at the time. They needed to learn to worship together and make the whole church work. And so much of the chapter speaks to strong and weak Christians, but there's no hint of disbelief or false doctrine in there. And Paul speaks of saved individuals with different experience and strength who needed to worship together, and they're commanded to make allowance for each other. Okay? Now, I believe this might be the very first time ever that I came up to this pulpit without a coat and tie on. And if we must be brutally honest, this is what I wore to speak this morning because the place I spoke is not a coat and tie church. And to be even more honest, I fell asleep in my chair and lacked the time to change, and so I came as I was. Now, is it important? I don't think so. It's my custom to dress in a certain way, but am I going to tell someone else, you must dress like I dress, or we can't have fellowship together? No. No. It's not important. And so, Paul is seeing, clearly saying here, the changes to the Gospels are not accepted in any way. The doctrine is the doctrine. We're not changing it. If something in it makes you uncomfortable, then chances are very good you need to make some changes. Maybe there's a closet that needs to be cleaned out somewhere. So the church must rebuke sharply and can't tolerate doctrines of this sort, because changes are unclean and dangerous. And there's many cases where the church cannot be open-minded. And so the world out there says, hey, take X off the sin list. We don't want that to be a sin anymore. We think it's okay. But we can't do it. And these issues are just as dangerous today as they were back then. In that respect, nothing has changed. Nothing has changed. Now, the areas where the church is being urged to compromise have changed. They're not the same as in the ancient world. We don't have emperor worship anymore. And there's many, many, many other things that have changed. But the fact that the change is being urged on the Christians has not materially changed over the years. We don't like that you say this. Don't say it anymore. This is almost the most pressing issue facing the church today. What do we change? What must we keep? And so when I say to you, is it important whether or not I have a coat and tie on? I'm not just having a little fun at my own expense. I'm dead serious. Is that something that would keep somebody away? Is that something that would drive somebody away? It shouldn't be. We've got to find a balance. We've got to sort out what's important. Some change must be resisted, but not all change is bad. So I say to you plainly, if we desire to keep the church just as it was in the 1950s, eventually the church will close its doors. Before smartphones, before laptops, before cell phones, so much change has come to the country. So much change, mainly due to technology. The gospel and the doctrine has absolutely got to remain intact. The warnings on false teaching are just as timely today as they were 2,000 years ago. Maybe more so. But customs and preferences are not on the same level. So when we say to someone, well, I like it this way, or this is the way it's always been done, we are absolutely positively no different than the Pharisees that says, why do your disciples transgress the tradition of the elders by eating with unwashed hands? Because you can't take a preference or a tradition and elevate it to the level of Scripture and doctrinal commands. We might like it that way, but that does not make it doctrine. Preference and customs change over the years. No church can remain just the same. And the churches have changed. Okay. There's no hitching rack out there for the horses. There's no stable out back to put them in cold weather. If we had to absolutely stay the same, those things were there in my great-grandfather's day when he went to church. But we have phased those out. Guess what? There's no outhouse out back. We're okay with embracing the change of indoor plumbing. That's all right. And so we see that there's changes. That's a change that was brought by technology. My great-grandfather's day, no one knew anything about indoor plumbing. Everybody had an outhouse, no one thought anything about it. And so we see some changes. Once upon a time, all the women wore hats to church. My great aunt never went anywhere without a hat and a pair of white gloves. No good lady did. But we've changed. We've changed. And so we've got to learn to differentiate between the preference and the custom and the habit of what we've always done and the gospel, as Paul advises, that we've got to cling to it. Hang on to it. Don't let it go. But we can't make what we prefer to be a test of faith, because that is not the gospel that we're clinging to. And the difficulty, the thing that worries me about the church and concerns me greatly, is if they cling to various preferences and things they like and customs that they're used to and comfortable with, and if the other hand loosens as far as clinging to the gospel. Because guess what? It's not a church anymore then. It's something that purports to be a church, but it's not a church. And so, as I say, that is the challenge facing us. Titus was to take and straighten out that church, and he was supposed to straighten it out with the gospel, concentrating on what was inside. He was not necessarily to go outside and challenge the various isms out there. That's what we need to do today. If we got a closing hymn, he's my guy that always keeps me on track, makes